ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, and welcome to this Friday edition of The Country Hour. I'm Selena Green. In a moment, we'll take a look at lamb prices and what they're doing, but also what the expectations are for Australia's cattle numbers this year.
In southern Australia, conditions, again, haven't been disastrous and the outlook is quite good into 2024. So any reduction in the herd in the south will just be because capacity has sort of reached its limit.
Don't forget, my talkback number today is 1300 222 891. As always, you can also text on 0467 922 891. The federal government has this week tabled legislation to establish a new biosecurity protection levy. That levy is due to start on the 1st of July and will help pay for the government's $1 billion a year biosecurity plan, with importers and taxpayers set to fork out the most money. The agricultural sector is set to pay 6%. Farmers have long cried out for better biosecurity, but this levy, it's not getting love from everyone. The National Farmers Federation President David Johinke has labelled the policy a dud.
Even the industry importing the goods have suggested that they have capacity to take on these costs. We've seen researchers and people within the industry demonstrate that this is a complex way of gathering additional funding, and the fact that up until this last moment we haven't had any genuine oversight, and even now we're not sure on the makeup of what that oversight is and how it operates, means that this bill needs to be reconsidered. It's just too rushed.
That is the National Farmers Federation President David Johinke there. Dr. Chris Parker, he's the CEO of Cattle Australia. He's a bit more upbeat. He says the federal government's decision to have an advisory panel for this levy is a good move.
Look, there's probably two things to this, mate. The first is that we've been concerned for some time, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, of the introduction of this biosecurity levy. But our view had been that if the government is going to persist with putting this in place, we needed it to be more equitable, and what we've been lobbying very strongly for is to have a say in the manner in which the biosecurity system is run.
And you feel like you now have that?
Well, the government announced yesterday and invited Cattle Australia onto a panel, and it's our understanding, and very clearly from discussions I had last night with the minister, that his expectation is that panel will oversight the entire biosecurity system. This, for me, is a win. Not so much the levy, and we still be up there talking to crossbenchers about the levy, but the panel itself is the first time that industry's had an oversight of what's been going on and where the money's spent and how it's spent, and that's a positive, notwithstanding the fact that the introduction of this levy, we believe, has been mishandled.
Again, the National Farmers Federation president says, this is a quote, it's pretty clear this panel is being tacked on at the 11th hour to try and give this levy some credibility, and he is cynical about it. What gives you confidence?
I'm not particularly interested in whether it gives the levy credibility. What I'm interested in is whether grass-fed cattle producers get a seat at the table to allow them to have an influence over where and how biosecurity money is spent. Mate, we've known for a long while that a lot of the threats are in the north, and I'm sure a heck of a lot of your listeners are acutely aware of where these threats are coming from. And from our perspective, we've supported the government's moves to both increase funding and provide more sustainability in that funding for biosecurity. Being a member of this panel is going to allow us to try and direct that funding, but also to continue to push for more funding that's better targeted.
So at this stage, Chris, have you got a sense on how much cattle producers might be paying when this levy kicks into gear?
So we're still in discussions with the Department of Agriculture and the Minister's Office about exactly what it looks like. But if it's done on GVP and it's done on the percentages that I've seen, it will be about 18% of the cattle industry share will be about 18% of $51 million, which will be about $9 million.
And have you worked out what that could mean per beast sold?
Well, this is the collection mechanism is still being negotiated, and we're very keen to make it equitable, and we certainly don't want to see the old system, which was just ridiculous, where it was charged every time a beast was sold, and that meant that we were paying up to three or four times, depending on how many times a beast was sold, and that was totally inequitable.
So are you keen to see this legislation passed in Parliament and for everyone to get on with it?
What we'd like to see is this go to committee. I want to see it go to committee, and we want to see all the issues brought out so we make sure that if the government is going to persist with this particular way of taking biosecurity funding forward, that it's done in the least harmful way and the most equitable way.
That was Dr. Chris Parker, the CEO of Cattle Australia. He was speaking there to Matt Brann. Well, there's some relief for lamb producers with a sustained rise of more than 50% in lamb price forward contracts since pre-Christmas. In October, lamb prices dipped into the $4 a kilogram, but this week saw prices north of $7.50 a kilogram. Reporter Liz Reimel asked Richard Harvey, who's a livestock agent with PPH&S in Narracourt, how much improvement he's seen since Christmas.
Well, I think, Liz, that if you take it on the basis of pre-Christmas, was probably, I'm not going to call it a panic sell-off, but it was probably the basis of a lot of producers taking a lot of factors into account that the sheep prices had altered from the previous year and come back to levels that were not expected and probably low as they've been for around that 12 to 15 years. The blokes are going, well, it's going to cost X to feed, weather forecast is going to be, reasonably dry and hard work. And at the moment they were thinking, well, if it doesn't rain, there was no point in carrying a lot of lambs through. So a lot of people offloaded in the spring a lot of woolly lambs, which then caused probably an oversupply, which then caused the prices to get worse, and then that's where we ended up there. And of course, now we've come out of it at Christmas and onwards, we've seen a bit of a shortage of those better end lambs, and that's why that part of the market's kicked. But in the same breath, we've had very, very strong demand from processors buying those sort of 14 to 19, 20 kilo lambs to do that little bag order and MK order, which is competing against the grazier. So that actually a lot of those little lambs are still getting their heads chopped off as well. So I think you'll see your processors going into that May, June, July with those forward prices wanting to hedge their bets because there could possibly be a slight shortage of lambs.
Were there producers that held over lambs that still may have lambs available from last season to sell, in the next couple of months into this type of price range?
I would say, Liz, that it's probably not, wouldn't be as high as the previous 2 years. I think a lot of people, a few blokes sold more lambs than they normally would have, just with the cost of shearing and the way the market was looking back in November, December, they offload them. So I think the number of lambs carried over would be slightly less.
And it's obviously been a bit of a tough start to, this season, pretty dry really since January, the last 7 weeks, really not much rain in the southeast, hardly anything. What are your producers telling you about how their season's going? Are they feeding ewes at the moment and, trying to get through before those first lambs start dropping?
I think probably right until the end of January, even early February, we were still in the grips of that, or in some areas got up to sort of 7 or 8 inches of rain. So they actually had another green pick that came through to the middle of January and that, and other areas were probably missed out a little bit. But definitely in the last fortnight to 10 days with that wind and the little bit hotter temperatures, the feed has crispened up pretty well and it's powdery and a lot of blokes are now starting to feed and get ready for the lambing. Definitely.
And MLA's come out with its latest look at the national sheep flock, which it says is going to contract by another around about 3% down this year. What's your take on those types of figures?
I actually thought it might have been a touch more than that, Liz. Our demand in the spring for replacement ewes was what I've seen for the last 5 to 6 years. A lot of blokes going up. Our old ewes are only worth $10 to $20. And I said, look, we'll probably take a punt and carry a few of them through, a few blokes even talking carrying them through dry, which have now actually all been sold. But I think that just the demand for those younger ewes in the spring definitely contracted. And, of course, we've got that swing now. It's very difficult. Not many people are putting the merinos out over merinos. So that side of the market's contracting as well. So I think it's been a twofold effect. That one, the way the market was looking, people cut numbers back. And two, the fact that we're not breeding a large percentage of merino to merinos is probably going to have an effect on it as well.
That's livestock agent with PPH&S Richard Harvey, and he was speaking to Liz Rymel. Well, Meat and Livestock Australia is expecting a slight reduction in the cattle herd this year, easing by less than 1% to 28.6 million a head by the end of June. This is one of the key figures in MLA's latest cattle projections, which look at the size of the herd, number of animals processed, carcass weights, meat production and exports for 2024 through to 2026. MLA's Stephen Bignall says the cattle herd has stabilised.
So it's been quite a good northern wet season, which means that northern Australia, where around 50% of the herd are, will be in a really good position for production purposes into 2024. And so that means that there's the capacity in that part of the herd, that half of the herd, to maintain. And then in southern Australia, conditions, again, haven't been disastrous, and the outlook is quite good into 2024. So any reduction in the herd in the south will just be because capacity has sort of reached its limit.
What are you looking at as we look across the country in terms of the slaughter figures? What are the projections?
So in 2023, slaughter jumped 1.2 million head. We don't have such a big jump this year. We've got slaughter returning to sort of 10-year averages and sitting at 7.9 million head. That'll be a jump of over 10% in the next calendar year.
And do you look at just the cattle exports out of the country as well?
We look at both the livestock exports and the actual total meat produced. And when we look out to 2026, we expect that Australia will produce 2.6 million tonnes of beef, and that will be in line with the records that we saw in 2014. So as the slaughter sort of jumps up over the next 3 years, and even if cattle weights sort of drop a little bit, that increase in slaughter will drive record production as we reach out to 2026.
All right, so that's a jump of 16% in meat production between now and 2026, is that right?
Yes.
And where will that go? Can that be on the domestic market, or we really have to look at the export market to look at that significant increase?
A lot of that increase will be going to export markets. So we've got a slight growth in the domestic utilisation number, and that's probably just reflective of increased population growth. And what we do see is the majority of that uplift in production will flow to export markets.
And do you look at specifically where in those export markets? Is it growth of the already established markets that we've got, or how do you break that down?
That figure is aggregated exports, but what we do know that will unfold over the next 3 years is that US drought is forecast to break, which means that the US herd will go into a period of rebuild like we've experienced over the last 4 years, and they will really retreat from those global export markets, which will provide an opportunity for Australian beef exporters, both in the US, because the US is a big importer of meat, despite being an exporter, and also the key markets that the US plays in, which is your Koreas, your Japan and China.
You also had a look at the live cattle export figures. What is that showing you, Stephen?
Yeah, so we've got around a jump in 50,000 head of cattle exports to over 720,000 next year. That puts us back in line with sort of the export figures from 2021. And as we go out to 2026, we have live exports jumping to over 800,000 head. We have them reaching 810,000 in 2026, which is sort of where they sat between 2020 and 2021.
And I guess that's the majority of that going to Indonesia.
Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, the usual markets.
So, you know, having a look at these figures from a cattle producer's perspective, what do you really take away from what you're seeing in these figures?
I think that we do know that the supply will hit the market. So if we talked last week about the official ABS figures and what we'd seen in 2023, we expect supply to continue to be elevated this year, and even as seasonal conditions sort of normalise or even dampen and sort of worsen a little bit over this forecast period, we do expect supply to come online and for that to be processed, but that will allow our export markets to flourish, and we do have the herd coming down as sort of the seasonal conditions dampen over those 3 years.
And can you draw anything at all in terms of prices from these sort of figures from a producer's perspective?
MLA don't do price forecast, that's the line we always say, but we do in the projections actually go out to industry analysts, and we get their aggregated price forecasts. So these aren't MLA forecasts, but we get them to forecast both the feeder steer price and the heavy steer price. And what they see is they actually see an improvement in both of those indicators out to 30 June. They've got the feeder steer sitting at 362.8 cents per kilo live weight out at 30 June, and they have the heavy steer sitting at 317.9 cents per kilo live weight at 30 June.
Right, so slightly up?
Slightly elevated.
On what we're seeing at the moment?
Yep.
That is Meat and Livestock Australia's Stephen Bignall going through the latest projections for the cattle herd in 2024. Speaking there to Belinda Varischetti. 20 minutes past 12. Well, yesterday, Timberlink officially opened its almost $70 million next timber manufacturing plant in Tarpina. Facility is the first in Australia to make both cross-laminated timber and glue-laminated timber, which can be used for large-scale commercial construction, even as timber skyscrapers. Colin Clements is the owner of AAA Advanced Trusses and Windows. He's a major buyer of Timberlink products. He says there will be demand in the industry for what's coming out of this new mill.
I've seen a couple plants around the world, and this is certainly top of the tree. I was lucky enough to be here 12 months ago when they were pouring the foundations, so in 12 months it's gone a long way. It will be remarkable for the state and the country when it's up and going, and it's the next generation of house building, or not so much house building, probably commercial building is where it lies. The thought that's gone into this premises is second to none.
So you are a big purchaser of Timberlink's products. Will you have a use for CLT and GLT?
Certain products we will. And the glue laminated beams, we certainly buy a huge amount. And when the facility is up and running, yeah, we will be purchasing in the vicinity probably $200,000 to $300,000 a month of the product. In the wall framing, beam, structural side of the house, we sell them with our frames and trusses to the residential builder, and we'll be promoting it too, and what more uses it can have to their business.
Owner of AAA Advanced Trusses and Windows, Colin Clements. Timberlink has only just started producing CLT and GLT panels in the previous months and has predicted it will take years to scale up to full capacity. When that happens, will they be able to find enough local timber to meet demands? This is a question I was able to ask Nathan Payne, Chief Executive Officer of the South Australian Forest Products Association, yesterday.
Look, that is a very interesting question, and one that we're absolutely looking at. One of the projects that was announced today by the government as part of the Domestic Manufacturing Infrastructure Master Plan was a State of the Forest report. That'll give us a better understanding about how much resource we've got versus how much demand we will need to meet in the future. I'm looking forward to getting that report underway so that we can really answer those questions and ensure that we identify any barriers that are inhibiting planting and more increasing plantations we can get out of the way.
Chief Executive Officer of the South Australian Forest Products Association, Nathan Payne. Premier Peter Malinauskas was in attendance yesterday at the launch, touring the Australian First facility. He says it is a leading example of why businesses should be investing into decarbonisation innovation.
I think this is a real life demonstration of how thoughtful government policy interacting with innovation from industry using their private capital can actually capitalise the decarbonisation opportunity in a way that delivers for working people. So now what we've got here is a highly productive facility capitalising on the decarbonisation of the global economy by producing construction supplies using fibre produced locally. It ticks every box. So this is actually quite important. In fact, it's a demonstration not just to the local industry but to the state writ large that there is opportunity in decarbonisation. It can deliver high-quality jobs if we've got thoughtful policy and innovation leadership from the private sector.
Would the government prioritise the materials built here on site into public housing, public buildings?
It's funny you should ask that. It might have been a discussion that we've had throughout the course of the day here. Look, I think government has a responsibility to show leadership in the market where we believe there are products being produced locally that deliver an outcome for our economy. And CLT, GLT is a good example of that. This is taking local fibre, using local labour to value add to it into a high quality product that could be a replacement for structural steel. Now, we make structural steel in South Australia. We want to use that too, but not a lot of it is imported. So we do see an opportunity there, and that's something we want to work on.
That is the Premier Peter Malinauskas ending that report from Elsie Adamo. Let's go to the Weather Bureau now, and our forecaster today at the Bureau is Mark Analak. Hello, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena.
What's the story for the last working day of the week?
Well, just looking back at the last 24 hours, we had a thunderstorm develop about the northern Flinders yesterday, and that produced of the order of 25 millimetres at Arkuna Bluff. And around that area, sort of through Lee Creek and just to the north of the Flinders there, we did see a number of locations recording some pretty good falls. The other system that moved through overnight last night was a band of middle-level cloud that stretched across northern Eyre Peninsula through the Flinders district and into sort of the southeastern part of the northeast pastoral district. That band continues to stream across that same area and probably will do so for the next 24 hours with embedded thunderstorms. So those showers also produced falls up to 20 millimetres as well. So for the next 24 hours, we're expecting that middle level cloud with embedded thunderstorms to persist about northern Eyre Peninsula, southern Flinders, and into the southeast of the northeast pastoral district right through. This afternoon, further north, plenty of clear sky at the moment, but this afternoon there's plenty of moisture available and we'll expect to see some afternoon convection developing, so showers and thunderstorms popping up over the pastoral districts later this afternoon. And keep an eye out for possibly severe thunderstorm warnings being issued for some of those storms that develop later this afternoon. Tomorrow will be almost a carbon copy of today. Southern agricultural areas will remain dry, but we don't have to look too much further north to see any shower activity. So that's that middle-level cloud streaming across the northern agricultural area and southern pastoral districts into tomorrow morning. And then again, tomorrow afternoon, thunderstorms developing about the northern pastoral areas. Moving in from the south and from the west, we have a southerly flow and a high pressure system eastern flank of that southerly a southerly wind on the eastern flank of that approaching high will push the showers and thunderstorms further north through the latter part of Saturday. So southern agricultural areas will start off dry, then as we move into the afternoon, those dry conditions will push into the northern agricultural areas. And then on Sunday, that southerly wind will continue to push the showers and thunderstorms right up to the northern border. So most of the state should be fine on Sunday. As we move into Monday, Tuesday, the high pressure system drifts over the sort of further east through the Bass Strait and into the Tasman Sea. With that, the winds will turn northerly and we're likely to see temperatures start to rise. Any shower and thunderstorm activity that sort of develops over WA will start to move in across the western border on Monday, Tuesday, and with any chance or with hope, we see some of that moisture pushing across agricultural areas midweek. In terms of rainfall amounts, obviously it's going to be very hit and miss with the showers and thunderstorms we're expecting. So generally we're looking at less than a couple of millimetres, but we could see areas of 2 to 10 millimetres across the pastoral and Flinders districts over the next few days, mostly in the next 24 to 48 hours. And if we do get a decent thunderstorm move over your area, you could see isolated local falls of 10 to 30 millimetres with each of those thunderstorms, namely this afternoon and tomorrow afternoon. So that's pretty much all from me. Keep an eye out for severe thunderstorm warnings for this afternoon, remaining very hot in the north, but dry conditions continuing across agricultural areas.
Thanks, Mark. Have a great rest of your Friday.
Thank you.
Mark Analak there from the Weather Bureau. Now, looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales, now for the upper and lower western districts for tomorrow, both expecting a partly cloudy day. There's a medium chance of showers in the far eastern parts of the upper western district, a slight chance across the lower western district. Both districts come with a chance of a thunderstorm tomorrow. Overnight temperatures will get down into the high teens to the high 20s. Daytime temperatures reaching the low 30s, up to around 40 degrees, or up to potentially about 42 degrees for the Upper Western District for tomorrow. You're with Selena Green. It is coming up to 12:30 here on the South Australian Country Hour. We are going to have a look at how vintage is looking for one of our busy wine districts. And the debate continues over the best way to get rid of feral deer.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Good afternoon. Well, there's a little debate over the damage and the danger feral deer are causing here in South Australia, but there is debate over the best way to get rid of them. And there has been some criticism of the state's aerial deer culling program, which is underway at the moment, but you'll hear from some farmers who say it's working. And find out why you're being asked to make sure that the honey that you're buying is Australian.
A lot of packers have got their sheds full of honey and are being selective about what they will and won't purchase. So even though our South Australian beekeepers are making a lot of honey, they are struggling to be able to shift it out of their sheds and sell it to processors and packers.
Yeah, so apparently it's been pretty good for producing honey here in South Australia, but they need to sell it. More on that to come. It's all coming up after you hear these news headlines from Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the latest seasonal bushfire outlook is forecasting an increased fire danger for parts of central and western Australia this autumn. The National Council for Fire and Emergency Services says there's an increased risk of fire for parts of central Australia, including Alice Springs, with elevated fuel loads. Above median temperatures and dry conditions are also expected to increase the risk of fires in western Australia's south. A 47-year-old in Counter Bay woman has been charged with fraudulently claiming government flood recovery grants. Detectives arrested her after she allegedly submitted false applications relating to the early business closure grant and the small business flood recovery grants, and members of a Senate committee have paused to pay respects to one of their serving colleagues, Linda White, who died overnight. The Labor senator was elected to Parliament in 2022 and recently announced she was taking leave due to health issues. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, yes, it's a very busy time for our state's wine industry, and vintage has kicked off in the state's southeast. It sounds like it's going to be a mixed bag for what will be coming out of some of your favourite local wine regions, depending on where the grapes are being grown. In Coonawarra, vintage has come a month earlier this year. Peter Balnaves is vineyard manager for Balnaves of Coonawarra. He says harvest has been going well so far, but they're having to navigate some tricky conditions.
Oh, it's been pretty hectic, actually. We've been picking Chardonnay and Coonawarra and Rattenbully Pinot Gris in the last week or 10 days. So that's sort of beginning to draw. We're nearly to the end of that, which is good. But, yeah, so far, so good.
And quality, quantity, how's it been looking?
I think slightly above average yields, but quite hard to estimate. Yeah, this year there was some pretty mild conditions during flowering, and that sort of has increased the variability a bit. But, yeah, slightly above average yields. It's interesting in that when we look at last year's or the last few years' data, we're about a month early for picking Chardonnay, nearly to the day. So it's a bit interesting in that it has been mild, but yet Chardonnay's still in advance of where we'd normally expect it to be.
And any major differences between the Coonawarra and Rattenbully grapes?
Not really. A slight increase in Bome, probably 0.4 of a Bome increase in Rattenbully. So tending to pick earlier, slightly earlier up there, so earlier in the week. But no, the yields are pretty similar across the two regions for what we see. Yeah, it looks good. I think nice to get whites out of the way because generally they've always got to be picked at night. So you've got split shifts of people coming in trying to pick the fruit as cool as we can, which was interesting last week when the minimum overnight temperature was about 26. It was a bit interesting as to how to deal with that. But yeah, we just started later in the night and dealt with it. But yeah, it was a pretty warm nighttime minimum temperature.
Have you been able to get enough workers?
We have. We've normally got an international in the winery, and that hasn't happened this year. But all of our other positions have sort of been filled. Probably a bit easier this year than other seasons, ironically. And I'm not sure what's driving that, but it's life's always made easier when you've got access to full-size crews.
And the grapes you've been harvesting so far, Peter, no impacts from, you know, downy or powdery mildew or any diseases?
No, look, it was certainly a very high-pressure year, one of the highest pressure years I've seen. And, you know, the people just had to react accordingly and get their preventative sprays on. So it was certainly the mildness caused issues with the lack of ability to get sulphurs and the like to vaporise because the daytime temperatures weren't warm enough. So that was a bit of an issue. And then we certainly had, after having the wettest June on record, we had very dry conditions in October and then it started to rain. So there's a few nervous moments, but so far so good. And the way it sits at the moment, things look very positive. And hopefully we don't get the tropical infeed of a heap of rain between now and harvest.
Yeah, so has this been really one of the most difficult seasons you've had to work through?
Well, it's probably varying degrees. I thought last year was difficult until we got into this year by way of just the mildness and all the different things that were going on. And also, I suppose, a few things that, because of last year's wet conditions, things like snails and the like were a bit of a challenge early. But they're all different in their own ways, and you can never really take your eye off the ball. So it's something you've just got to chase right through to the finish line, because if you do take your foot off the accelerator, you can guarantee that you'll get caught with something.
And as you said, they're still on the vine at the moment, but hopeful that the red wine grapes will be okay as well this year?
No reason at this stage not to think they won't be. We're doing tests at the moment to sort of see where the maturity level is in the scheme of things, but they seem to be advanced as well, particularly Merlot and some blocks of Shiraz, sort of probably 2 to 3 weeks away from harvest, and we're probably expecting the peak to be either side of Easter, so the end of March.
Vineyard manager for Balnaves of Coonawarra, Peter Balnaves. In the upper southeast, growers have had a bit of an easier time than in Coonawarra. The weather has been on the side of growers in the Padthaway wine region after a dry February made managing diseases easier. Padthaway wine region president Christine McElroy says vintage has gotten off to a smooth start.
So it started pretty steady, really. I think most people, I'm taking a big guess here, would be almost finished their white. It's been a nice steady harvest, not like other years where it's all frantic and everything's coming together. So it's been good, I think, so far from what I can gather.
And earlier?
Oh, it's about on par. We started about when we normally do, and reds are looking like they might be 10 days to 2 weeks away maybe before we start. Some might be a little bit earlier, but it's pretty standard, really. It's potentially almost a normal year, but I hate to say that word, but it's about standard.
Right. And how's the quality of the grapes looking?
Quality's looking good in the whites, and the reds are looking pretty happy with themselves too. So we're, I guess, in the current climate with grapes and vineyards, things aren't all that happy, but to see some good quality coming through, putting a smile on some faces.
Yes, I was going to ask how the growers generally feeling. It is a bit of a hard time for them at the moment, not the best prices and not everyone under contract, I imagine, either.
Yeah, it is a tough time for the whole of the industry across the country, and, you know, just working out, you know, what's the best way for your vineyard, what's the best for the industry, do we continue to do what we do, what do we need to change, those sorts of things are on everyone's mind constantly, outside of the fact, you know, trying to sell your grapes is a challenge for everyone, and that's industry-wide as well.
So earlier in the season, I had a few conversations with viticulturalists about a bit of a tough fight against downy and powdery mildew this season. Has that had any impact on the grapes in Padthaway?
No, not really. There was some concern in sort of mid-January when, you know, after December and January were quite wet and humid, there was some early disease pressure, but we managed to get on top of that really well. And then once the rain stopped mid-January and the warmer temperatures come along, that removed virtually all the disease pressure around our region, which is fantastic. There is a bright light at the end of the tunnel there somewhere.
Padthaway Wine Region President Christine McElroy. It's not an easy time for those in the industry, with low prices and demand really putting on the pressure. Executive Officer of Coonawarra Vignerons Hugh Coff says while most are trying to stay positive, it is a bit of a struggle.
Look, there's no doubt it's been a really stressful time for the industry. we all know, and we don't hide from that fact. I think Coonawarra is certainly very blessed that we've been placed in the premium end and, of the market for many years, and a lot of our grapes end up in those premium products in different companies, and also too in the different wines. So that's been, I suppose, a bit of a saving grace and something we've worked towards. But look, there's no doubt that it's a tricky time, and I think our growers are just hopeful that another good vintage going forward is going to produce some really good quality, and we can just keep trying our very best to hopefully see China open back up again at some point. That might relieve the pressure valve, but there's a lot to get through in the next little while, and our vintnerongs are really wide awake to what that might be. And I think at the moment they're still feeling still feeling all right, but it's certainly been a struggle.
Yeah, I was going to ask, with the info session recently about trade with China, were there many questions from the vignerons with that?
Yeah, look, I think it was interesting to see the big response we got from our members was that China is not going to be the same place it was before, 2020, 2021. And that what we're seeing now is a much more regulatory environment around China, and also a much more political environment as well. And anyone who's entering that market needs to be well and truly ready for that and be well prepared, and understanding that, yes, it's going to be quite a big market to go back into it as it was, but if you put a foot wrong, it could be quite detrimental. And also, too, I think that, people are looking forward to seeing what that might look like and renewing, some of the old relationships into China particularly. And that is only going to, hopefully bode well more broadly. But I think people have taken a very, a very cautious approach going back into that market.
That is the Executive Officer of Coonawarra Vignerons, Hugh Coff, ending that story from Elsie Adamo. And it is 20 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Well, what's the best way to wipe out feral deer from South Australia? And we have covered a fair bit of this debate lately, including a recent meeting of hunters in the state's southeast, where they raised concerns about the current aerial deer culling program. Well, landowners in the southeast called for their own meeting with the Primary Industries Minister, Claire Scriven, yesterday to discuss the program. And ABC reporter Eugene Boisvert was invited along on a charter flight with the minister and local landowners, flying over the Kalaira area to see the damage that's been inflicted by feral deer firsthand. David Rashid, well, he owns Bullapucky Farm. He told Eugene what efforts they've gone to slow down feral deer movements on their land.
We put up over 7 kilometres of deer fence now, just in the last 10 years, I suppose, just purely trying to keep the feral deer out of our established pastures. When we're trying to grow new perennial pastures, mostly lucerne, we've really struggled to get the pasture established with the number of feral deer that have been coming in and eating off the new shoots. But so we, put up 7 kilometres of deer fence to try and at least slow them down and make them go the long way around.
Yeah, so is that a big expense?
Yeah, it's probably cost twice as much as a normal fence. And we had existing fences there as well, so we've actually put them in, replaced fences that probably didn't need replacing, but purely to get the deer fence in.
So what damage do deer cause on the property?
Trying to establish those new pastures, they really like eating the best feed possible, and the fresh shoots off the new lucerne is one of their number one targets, so they really go after that. And they eat it down to a level where it's so low that it actually kills the new plant. But that's one of the main issues. And then also we've had trouble with people that are coming in illegally shooting the feral deer on our place, poachers that we don't really know who they are or where they are. Or so we've put probably over $1,000 worth of locks on all our gates to making sure we can try and keep them out as well, but they obviously still find a way sometimes as well.
Yeah, how big a problem is it?
It's a big problem. Over the last few years, especially with the aerial shoot and the ground shoot that the landscape board's been doing, that's certainly, the numbers have really dropped off in the last few years especially, and it's getting to the point now where it's rare to see a deer out in the landscape, whereas before it was quite common, or just about 100% chance of seeing one. But now the numbers have certainly dropped dramatically, and it's really is a testament to the program that the numbers are reducing so much.
What do you think of the aerial culling program compared to hunting them on the ground yourself, or having hunters do it?
Yeah, we've had hunters shooting on our place for probably the last 30 years. They've probably been doing a minimal amount of control, but the numbers that they get is nothing compared to what the aerial shoot gets. We had over 400 deer shot at our place in the first aerial cull, and the ground shooters just cannot shoot those sort of numbers. And to wipe that many out of the system in one go, it just drops the numbers down so much that I think the aerial cull was amongst the other, with the other prop things like the ground cull and the private shooters that we've been having consistently, that they're all working together to get the numbers down to hopefully a level where there's none around.
That was farmer David Rashid. Well, Tammy Parker also owns farmland near Kingston and said feral deer have been causing huge damage on her property.
A huge effect. We're definitely on the southern fringes of it, and we've been involved with the program since its inception. We were trying to do our own control measures, and we still are to this date, but with the ground harvesting, which we're a big fan of, and the aerial culling, and the huge commitment that the Landscape Board and the government funding has provided, we can see that there's a reduction in the numbers, and we can see our economic viability has increased again. We've got better pastures, our biodiversity, for example, our mallee fowl are coming back. And then, as it got brought up today with discussions, it just really highlights every farmer around has got issues with safety, with illegal hunters coming onto our properties over the years. We've had a cow shot, we've had tanks shot at, and pipelines shot, and all those sorts of insignificant issues maybe to other people, but that's our piece of land and that's our livelihood and that's our lifestyle. And to have your safety at risk is always a big issue. And it's been really highlighted today that the funding from the government, the Landscape Board, their efforts has really been a fantastic byproduct that now we're having very few poachers around. And we can just see that we're all feeling safer as farmers. We're not having the door knockers every couple of weekends coming to ask to shoot. We're not hearing the gunshots. We're not having our spotlights shone in our windows anymore. On top of that, our pastures are increased, so that means our stocking rates can improve. And on top of that, being a big fan of the ground harvesting, at the end of the day, we are farmers and we produce meat. And to put food on people's tables, put meat in, on the supermarket shelves, and to see a ground harvester be able to utilise that meat, and they can on-sell that and put that onto the supermarket shelves to help feed the world through a pest, a declared pest, I just see that as a win-win for everybody.
Can you just describe some of the environmental effects that deer have?
That deer have? Oh, absolutely everything. Fences mean nothing to deer, so they can spread and they just go wherever the feed is. So especially in a drier season, you're trying to grow lucerne, which is a very much a summer active pasture. And they'll harbour in the scrubs, that's where they hide, but they'll come out and feed on the best of the pastures at night time. And your stocking rates are decimated, and in our scrub we've done actually about 6 kilometres of exclusion fencing, which involves electricity, multiple wires, and we've done that to just try to get our deer out of our scrub and keep it pest free. And we're just seeing our mallee fowl, which is a very rare species around here, just starting to flourish again, because the deer would get in and absolutely decimate the nests with their antlers, and they'd fight and ruin the nest. The nests are a couple of metres by a couple of metres wide. And just the other security issues of things like foot rot or any other diseases that, you know, once we see them as a nation, as a farmer, it'll be too late, because we've got feral deer just running around the landscape not caring where boundaries are. So they're a huge biosecurity risk, and they're a huge safety risk, and they decimate the agricultural industry. The economic losses, I don't know the figures on those, but they're significant.
That is Southeast farmer Tammy Parker speaking there with Eugene Boisvert. It is 13 minutes to one.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And you're with Selena Green on this Friday. Well, the Australian Honeybee Industry Council is urging consumers to buy Australian honey and looking for ways to increase exports as the national stockpile of honey increases. CEO Danny Lefebvre says prices being paid to commercial beekeepers have tumbled from highs of $6 a kilogram a few years ago and to $4.50 a kilo. Jennifer Nichols asked him how honey production is travelling here in Australia.
The eastern seaboard had a reasonably good start to the season, but then we've had some pretty heavy rainfall across a lot of the eastern seaboard. And as beekeepers find a honey flow and get on honey flow, it's been washed out this year. So the eastern seaboard's probably not had a fantastic year, probably an average year. Moving across to South Australia, they've had a fantastic season, a lot of honey being produced in South Australia. Western Australians have also struggled to find solid honey flows. There's a good Maori flow at the moment. Maori tree provides an active material
medicinal honey, and then Tasmania's had a reasonable leatherwood flow. So a bit of a mixed bag across the country, but probably across the board an average season.
And how has the varroa mite so far impacted honey production?
It's restricted the beekeeper's abilities to move freely as they normally would. Beekeeping across the eastern seaboard is highly mobile. Bees will move from Queensland to Victoria and back again and everywhere in between. So with our borders having significant restrictions on movements because of the varroa mite in New South Wales, it has restricted the ability, say, for Queensland beekeepers who would normally venture south to find honey flows to do so. They're able to go south, but they are not able to come home back to Queensland. So it has impacted a lot of the beekeepers' ability to do what they would normally do.
There must be a very nervous people out there wondering when it's going to cross borders and enter different states and territories.
It's a waiting game. We know it will happen. It will spread. It's spread everywhere else in the world. But it's a race to try and make sure that our beekeepers are prepared before it gets there. So we know that the most effective way to minimise the impacts and slow the spread is to provide the education and the extension to beekeepers. We do have a issue nationally where the honey price has dropped. So we're seeing it down to $4.50 a kilo farm gate price for our beekeepers, which is down from only a couple of years ago of $6 a kilo highs. So a significant drop in price. A lot of packers have got their sheds full of honey and are being selective about what they will and won't purchase. So even though our South Australian beekeepers are making a lot of honey, they are struggling to be able to shift it out of their sheds and sell it to processors and packers. Over the last 3 years, there's been an additional 200,000 hives in the system. We also know that our honey exports are at the lowest point since the 1960s, with only 3,000 tonnes going out. Honey imports have been stable for nearly a decade at about 8,000 tonnes. So we know that there's multiple reasons why honey prices are dropping at the moment. The global commodity price is at about $3.80 a kilo, so we're paying our beekeepers more than the global commodity price. So it's not as simple, in our view, as one factor influencing the pricing. It's a multi-factor issue at the moment.
Why have we got an extra 200,000 hives in the system?
So beekeepers have increased their hive numbers. So the split of that 200,000 hives, about half of that's been managed by recreational beekeepers or beekeepers who manage 50 hives or less. And the other half is being managed by commercial beekeepers. So when you put additional 200,000 hives in a national headcount of about 850,000 hives, it's quite significant the amount of additional honey that we're putting in the system as well.
Over what time have those extra 200,000 hives come on?
Since 2019.
Gee.
Were 27,000 recreational beekeepers registered in 2019, and now there's 47,000 recreational beekeepers registered in 2023. So we're seeing a huge increase in interest in beehive and expansion of the industry. And perhaps our supply chain hasn't kept up with that expansion.
So what do you have to do from here then? Get more people to eat honey?
We'd like to. So we, as a peak representative body, are working on multiple avenues. We're really focused on trying to establish and promote export opportunities, find new export destinations and increase our existing partnerships to try and shift some honey out of the country. We are making sure that the honey coming into the country is honey and keeping a close eye on where it's coming from and where it's going in Australia. We're also encouraging consumers, given that our beekeepers are really struggling at the moment with varroa, depressed prices, and our consumers can change that by focusing on buying pure Australian honey on the shelves rather than imported honey.
And how many commercial beekeepers are registered in Australia?
So we know there's about 1,800 registered commercial beekeepers, and that's been really stable over the last decades.
How's honey consumption been going?
Pretty stable. So we know the shelf sales in supermarkets has been stable. We do also know that right across all categories in the supermarkets, consumers are reaching for the cheaper end of those categories. There has been a slight increase in sales of imported honey on the supermarket shelves, but that's true across all categories in supermarkets as the cost of living really pinches on the hip pocket.
And you were talking about making sure it's real honey. I mean, there was a scandal a few years back when some of the honey that was being tested on the shelves wasn't actually honey.
Yeah, look, we worked through that process a few years back. We know the Australian honey that's on the shelf is some of the most pure in the world. We are very confident that our honey is the best honey that you can buy. We know honey that can come in from other regions around the world has been identified in other countries. In Europe, they've identified some adulteration with imported honey, and same with the US. So we're keeping a very close eye on that. We've identified some honey that's come in that we've alerted authorities, and that's been removed from the shelf.
health. But we keep a close eye on and watching brief.
That's Australian Honeybee Industry Council CEO Danny Lefebvre speaking to Jennifer Nichols. And a spokesperson for the Federal Department of Agriculture says that since March 2021, there have been 8 detections of adulterated imported honey tested under the Imported Food Inspection Scheme. 4 of those from Malaysia and 1 from Serbia were adulterated with C4 sugars like sugarcane or corn syrup. It's 6 minutes to 1. Finally today, as of now, the mango industry will no longer be allowed to use a chemical called methyl bromide to control fruit flies. The decision follows research into the chemical, which indicated it was not suitable for mangoes and didn't provide sufficient control for Queensland fruit fly. As a result, the states of South Australia, Tasmania and WA have updated their import conditions and will no longer accept mangoes that have used this treatment, and the same ban will be enforced on plums this month. Lee Scaleros is the president of the Northern Territory Mango Industry Association, says growers have now lost 2 cost-effective options for controlling fruit flies in the last 6 months.
Well, basically, last year we had dimethylate come off the label, and our option going into Western Australia was methyl bromide. That was then had some tests done and found that it wasn't an effective treatment on mangoes and plums in controlling fruit fly. So that's now been taken off the label, and we're looking for alternative forms of treatments for entry into some states.
So the industry lost the ability to use dimethylate as a post-harvest treatment. A lot of growers then went and grabbed some methyl bromide, and now as of today, that's been banned. So what are the alternatives from here, Leo?
Well, we have CTMO1, which is field sprays with dimethylate and hard green protocol for South Australia. So that's not too much of an issue. Entry into Western Australia is a larger issue, and we have irradiation and vapor heat treatment currently, and the department and industry is looking to get CTMO1 passed for Western Australia, but that might take some time.
I guess you're hoping that's all organised in time for the next mango season.
Yes, definitely. Well, the other two forms are an expensive treatment, and it also some transport logistics there will cause large dramas trying to swing fruit around the place.
So in terms of the bottom line for mango growers, how big of a deal is it to lose first dimethylate as a post-harvest treatment and now to lose methyl bromide?
Well, I mean, costs of some of these treatments can go up to $7 a tray, which a lot of growers are just struggling to clear a few dollars a tray after cost. So it will make them unviable, basically, to run. And if they can't go into these other states, then they'll have to send the fruit across to other states that don't require entry for fruit fly, which will cause basically a glut in the market and drop the market prices. So
a lot of mangoes going to New South Wales and Victoria and not much going to, say, WA.
Yes, and Queensland as well. So they all have the fruit fly of concern. So we don't need any protocols to enter those states.
That is Leo Scaleros there. He's president of the Northern Territory Mango Industry Association, and he was speaking there to Matt Brand. That's pretty much it from me from today and for this week. And the good news is that this afternoon you'll hear the dulcet tones of Nikolai Balhart's back on your radio. He's back. Hello, Nikolai.
Hello. Hopefully they're not too nasally or slightly congested. COVID got me again.
Oh, no, you poor thing. Oh, it's good to have you back, and hopefully you're starting to feel on the up.
Yeah, absolutely. You're definitely feeling well, much better than I was, because tell you what, it really did. And I know various people, and some people are lucky enough to maybe not be quite so affected. But no, it was quite unpleasant. Surprise, surprise. Who would have guessed?
Surprise, who would have thought? Well, what have you got for us on this Friday?
Well, you've probably heard of microplastics, the idea of microplastics, and now there's nanoplastics as well, which are even smaller again. Basically, I mean, it kind of does what it says on the tin to a degree. They're plastics that are really, really small, but as a result of that, they can get into us, into our bodies, but also into our environment in ways that I think are still really being figured out. And there's a big conference that's just about to be held in Adelaide, which is looking at how microplastics can affect, well, both human health but also the environment and in terms of things like agricultural production. So we're going to take a look at that today because it's at the point where, okay, we've known about it for a while, but they're still figuring out how to correctly analyse just how many microplastics are around. So we'll hear more about that soon.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know what's it doing to us. I think that's a very interesting question to know. Mm. We're still learning a lot about that. That'll be an interesting discussion. Well, hope you're feeling better and on the way up, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Nikolai Balahartz will be with you this afternoon, back on the afternoon's program. Thanks for your company today and all this week. It's coming up to 1 o'clock news time.
Lend us your ears and make life easier by using the ABC Listen app in the car. It will automatically quieten when you get calls or navigation instructions. Just make sure you favourite your local ABC radio station.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.